The Buddhist world is quite crude in the way it really wants to tell us that life is no joke. And the Buddhist texts are kind of quite sharp. And again, there are these rather scary quotes of the Buddha that says, life has no protector. Life has to be left. You'll have to leave everything behind. There's no safety, ultimately. There's no permanence. Everything goes. And quite kind of scary stuff. In fact, there is some very famous five remembrances which the monks say every day, many times, sometimes many times, and it's said on burials in the Buddhist cultures. When there's burial, someone dies in the Levaya, they say these five remembrances, and I'll read them to you in Hebrew and in English. Baderech ha-teva ani izdaken, ein manos mezikna. And it is the nature for me to get old. There's no escaping being old. Baderech ha-teva ani echle, ein manos l'machala. So the nature for me to be sick. There's no escape from being sick. B'derech ha-teva ani amut, ein manos mimavet. It's of the nature for me to die. There's no escape from death. B'derech ha-teva kol hayikar li v'ha'uv li ishtaneh, ein manos mipreda. It's of the nature that everything precious to me or that I love will change. There's no getting away from separation. Maasai hem rechushi hayechid, hem akarkar mitachat leraglai, ein manos metotzaot maasai. That my actions, in other words, everything I do, is the only thing that I have. This is the ground underneath my feet. There's no getting away, there's no escape from the fact of the results of my actions or my life, my being, what I do. So it's really the Buddhist way is to look truth straight in the face, gova inayim, look at the fact that we suffer and disappear, and not run away from it, and not dress it up, and not turn it into some kind of new age fiction or pleasure palace. So the fundamental vulnerability, pagiyut, of all living beings is actually a power for change and for transformation, and is not something that we should hide or get away from. The tendency to want to control the uncontrollable. We cannot control life. Life controls us. We are the result of life. We can't control it. So there's a truth in that which we don't want to run away from. But we try. We try to run away from it. And we do that by creating a comfort. What the Buddha, mythology of the Buddha was that he had a comfort palace. He was a prince and he had a palace of comfort where his father didn't allow him to leave to see any suffering. So he was inside this pleasure palace. And we do the same. We build ourselves a safe protected place, comfortable place, because of the uncontrollable nature of things, which we try and protect ourselves against by building a kind of castle of comfort called my flat in Tel Aviv, my car, my house, my money in the bank, my food, what I like, my friends, my people, my. Oh my. And okay, it's fine to have joy and it's fine to have pleasure. There's no law against it. The problem is that we spend our entire life defending and building the walls and rebuilding the walls when they start to fall down of this comfort palace or prison. And the investment in keeping it going, defending ourselves all the time, that's the problem. Not the joy of a great cup of coffee in Tel Aviv. No problem with that whatsoever. And the cake that goes with it. No problem. Or the English beer if you happen to be English. So we are so busy kind of looking after ourselves and our life and our world and defending ourselves against exactly that change that is taking us to pieces, that is separating us from everything we like. And it's not the body. The biggest protection is the self. That all the time we are busy protecting the self. Even when the body is fantastically healthy, we want to be liked, we want to be successful, we want to be accepted, we want to have a feeling of being okay with ourselves and not down on ourselves, not made small. We want to be made big, not made small. So the self is very busy. Any insult, any word from somebody can utterly destroy us. But the self, not the body. So the self carries on. We protect the body and then the self keeps going and protecting itself, even if the body is absolutely fine. So there's that's why it's non-stop. Non-stop. And then somehow we pay a lot of price. Everything tends to disturb us. Everything can easily disturb us. We're disturbed and pushed off balance. How many times we hear, oh, my life is out of balance at the moment. I need to get in balance. Well, there is no balance in life. How can we ask life to give us balance? What? Poor life. It has to keep supplying human beings with balance. Bit of this, bit of that, just enough of this, not too much, too little. Life has got to do that. There is no balance in life. So we keep demanding the balance. We want the balance. Life to supply us with everything plus balance. And in the spiritual life too, in our practice, it's so, so easy to go for comfort and not for truth. It's very subtle. Everybody does it. We just need to be sympathetic and know that everybody does it. And it's okay, but we have to realize that that's what we're doing. We want calmness. How many of us all the time say, well, my meditation has to be calm. In other words, we're still wanting supply, to be supplied. My meditation has to supply me the sapek, roga. Otherwise, there's something wrong. It's not, I'm not blaming anybody here. This is our nature to do that. I'm the same. I'm not like that now, but I certainly was for years thinking meditation has to do this for me and that for me and that for me. And putting pressure on our spiritual life to supply us with calm or well-being or happiness when spiritual life is about truth, not about supplying anything. And we can go through periods of difficulty in our spiritual life when we really do hunger for calm and so on, and it's okay. But we just have to remember, sometimes it makes us uncomfortable. Sometimes it makes us sensitive and vulnerable. It's not super medicine. So in that situation, in this particular situation of the human being born into a body and struggling in this way to control things and to get supplied with comfort, it's really important that we address the issue of equanimity, of how to stay steady with the truth. How to stay in the middle of things with the truth and be right there and be steady with it. To take our place on this planet with our 2 feet on the ground and say, I am here, I am ready for the uncontrollable life. I'm 2 feet on the ground, on the earth. Here I am, and I'm ready for whatever life wants to do. That is not easy. In a simple way, it means allowing life to do things to us, but not knock us over. There is this toy, Nachum Takum, I think. You can knock it, but it comes up, and it keeps coming up, because there's a good ground underneath, which you can call equanimity. Our base, we are steady. A meditation, samadhi, concentration, our ability to sit right here with what comes up for 45 minutes and again 45 minutes and again 45 minutes. That makes us steady. We are facing what comes up. We are grounded in our life. The nature of equanimity, the quality of equanimity, however, is dynamic. It has a sense that everything is workable. Everything is possible. Instead of protecting ourselves, it has an openness to allow things to arise. It's allowing, it's permitting things to arise with the steadiness. The more steady we are, the more we can be with whatever arises. So I want to give some examples of equanimity, some images. And here's a small story I found in the war in Bosnia. There was a man called Vedran Smalovic, and he was the cello player of the Sarajevo Opera Company. And his response, I'll read this now. His response to the conflict and all the chaos was to put on his formal concert clothes, black clothes, walk out of his apartment into the middle of the battle raging around him, and play his cello every afternoon for an hour. He would place a little stool in the middle of the bomb craters and play a concert to the abandoned streets while bombs dropped and bullets flew around him. Day after day, he made his own personal and courageous stand for human dignity, for civilization, for compassion, and for peace. Miraculously, he was never harmed. And all the newspapers picked up the story of this extraordinary man sitting in his white tie and black suit on a stool in the center of a raging, hellish war zone and playing his cello to the empty air. There's another example which many of you know, a poem by Rudyard Kipling called If. And I won't read the whole poem, but just a few lines give you a sense. And I sent you also a couple of articles in Hebrew that maybe came to you by now. And the first line of the If is the title of one of my articles that I sent. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you and make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting or being lied about but don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good, nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster, and treat these two imposters, means false beings, just the same. Give a flavor of it, of being bigger than the dualities of praise and blame, of things that arise, of difficulty of different kinds. There's a famous story which is of equanimity, Buddhist story, which is equanimity, which we can't even imagine, about a general in the army of Genghis Khan, it's supposed to be, but it could be anybody or any time, who came to a monastery in China, Buddhist monastery, and knocked on the door. And there was no answer for a long time, and he got very angry because he was a big general in the army. And eventually a monk came and opened the door, and the angry general said, "Do you know who I am? I am this general, and I can cut you in two pieces with my sword in the blink of an eye." And the monk said, "Do you know who I am? I am the monk, so-and-so his name. And I can be cut into two pieces without blinking an eye." So there is a nice, just I want to share with you three images of equanimity, which all of which have a different character, but they are all of them on the way to equanimity. One image is the rock. The rock is we sit like we have been doing, steady like a rock, in the middle of the stream, of the river, of our thoughts and our experiences that just stream past, but we sit steady like a rock. There is this thought, we sit steady. There is this feeling, we sit steady. There is anger, we sit steady. There is joy, we sit steady. There is pain, we sit steady. There is tiredness, we sit steady. That's the rock. Another image is the image of the basket. And the basket is very light. And when the wind blows, it blows the basket, it just rolls. And it always is okay. It's not destroyed because it's so light. And let the wind blow it. So let the wind blow us. We can roll. We're okay. Nothing can hurt us. We cannot be hurt. Because to be hurt, we need to have resistance. We need to have friction. The basket rolls and it's okay. A third image is the glass. That things just pass through. They do go into the glass, but they go out again. And maybe that's more true to the Buddhist, the essence of equanimity, that things do come through us, but they don't stick inside, so we're not hurt. It's not, the glass is not a wall. It's a glass. Things do go in. We do feel. We do laugh. We do cry. We do enjoy, we do get sad, we have emotional life, we have physical life, we have body life, we have mental life, we have love life, all of that. But things flow through. So what equanimity is not. One of the very common confusions and uncertainties about equanimity is that it's often seen as a form of anesthesia, of shutting things out, of shutting down. In other words, adishut. And these two are very often confused. Adishut and equanimity. And they're actually quite different. Adishut is about pushing things away, is still the barrier, is still the walls, is still the being inside the comfort zone and protecting ourselves with, I don't want this, and I don't want that, and I don't want that. So adishut is actually a negative sense of shutting down. Equanimity is not that. Equanimity is very alive, ready for anything, inviting everything to happen, but not be destroyed. There's a different energy altogether. There's no withdrawal. Nasiga, in equanimity. There's no shutting down or cloudiness. There's clarity. T.S. Eliot wrote very beautifully about this. He said, there are three conditions which often look alike, yet they differ completely, although they grow in the same hedgerow, gaderchai. Attachment to self and to things and to persons, detachment from self and from things and from persons. And growing between them, indifference, adishut, which resembles the others as death resembles life. So, in other words, adishut and equanimity or detachment, non-attachment, look similar, but they're like death is similar to life. It's similar to life, but it's the other side. It's part of life, death. It's not part of life, but it's very different. Another thing that equanimity is not, I said it before, it's not balance. It's not trying to get everything in balance. We hear it all the time, and it's so easy to go there. Oh, my life is out of balance. I need more balance. I need more, not so much this and more that. I need more. It'd be great balance if I had more love in my life, or if I had less busyness in my life, or more this, or less that, or, and equanimity is not balance. It's being in the middle, steady, when there's no balance. When things are out of balance. And we're in the middle. We're not destroyed by it. Another thing that equanimity is not, is it's not some kind of positive psychology or being very beseda with everything. Which, again, it can be commonly felt, okay, equanimity is being absolutely fine and relaxed and okay with everything and being kind of besederiyut, kind of. And it's not this being beseda with everything. It's very important to be joyful and be beseda. It's fine and it's good and it's helpful in our spiritual life. But equanimity is being free and right in the middle of whatever, whether it's joyful or not, whether it's happiness or sadness. So as I said yesterday, the key to equanimity is intimacy. If we are intimate with our experience in the moment, we are intimate, we are close to life, we have the taste then of being together with life, and that connectedness gives us protection, gives us equanimity, gives us steadiness. We are right with things, not running away. Just like when we run away from a wave, it knocks us down. When we're in the wave, we're safe. It's that movement, being right in the middle of life, we're actually safe. Ve'ena sera. So intimacy is being in the middle all the time. Difficult thoughts come up. I'm in the middle of them. That's okay, let them come. Experiences that we don't like, I'm in the middle, let it come. I'm ready, I'm here, I'm with. The other day, I think it was just, I don't know, seemed a few days ago, I don't exactly remember which form it was. Someone was telling me a very simple thing about, it was in Klil, in Mashiv Nefesh, some days ago. Someone was saying how a fly kept settling on their face during meditation. And the fly was just busy kind of walking here and started to go inside here and in the ears and, you know, just wouldn't leave this person alone. And at the beginning, tremendously disturbing and irritating and a real disturbing fly and cursing the fly and wishing it would just die, disappear. And then something changed in this person and they said they actually started to feel connected to the fly. A little bit looking at the world from the fly's point of view. And all of a sudden, intimacy with the fly. Yeah, the fly's walking around on me. The fly and I are sort of together in this moment, where there's some sort of fate has put us together. And experiencing the walking of the fly as sensations on the skin. Okay, it's just touch. Rather gentle, actually. Yeah, there's one right here. It's come to demonstrate. Again, here. It's demonstrating. It's sensations. It's togetherness. It's intimacy in that moment. He was able to change the view to one of intimacy, and the fly was no longer a disturbance. It simply wasn't disturbing anymore. There was a relationship based on some connection. It's very, very simple. So here's a very small example, but very simple example of the shift from life is disturbing to I am with it and we are together and I cannot be disturbed. In the intimacy, there is no disturbance. It's togetherness. So, the intimacy is also emptiness. And we all hear this word so often. But I don't like emptiness as a concept. We can write lots of books and loads of Buddhist books been written about emptiness and non-self or no selfing, anatta. But I prefer to express it in a more practical language, that this intimacy, this sense of being with the arising of things that happen in life is actually reducing the controller or the agent or the subject, me, inside this wall that has to experience certain things comfortably. The intimacy itself, like the intimacy with pain in the back, or the intimacy with someone we don't like, or the intimacy with the fly, or the intimacy with the other, or the intimacy with a person that we had conflict with for 10 years, and all of a sudden we see them in a totally different way as a suffering human being like us. That intimacy in that moment, the conflict has gone. That intimacy has in it strong element of no self, of not being a subject with walls protecting myself, the self. And this emptiness, which comes directly from mindfulness, brings steadiness in its path. It invites steadiness. It invites equanimity, because simply things pass it through us. We write standing in the middle, but things pass through. They touch us and move on. There's a Zen phrase. What is the heart of a wise man? It's a gentle wind under the sky. It's a lovely phrase. What's the heart of a wise man? It's a gentle wind under the sky. Still With that, we will go to the doctor if we need. We will look after ourselves if we need. It's not against protecting this body when we need to look after it. And we do it with equanimity. If the doctor says, sorry, nothing I can do, we take that with equanimity. If the doctor gives us a pill, we take that with equanimity. The Buddha certainly ate when he was hungry and took medicine when he was sick. It's natural. It's nothing, it's no big deal. It's not instead of, doesn't mean if we're equanimous, we just have to kind of not do anything and not look after anything. And no, we do what's natural. It happens by itself. But we're not busy trying to select this and choose that and only what I like and push away what I don't like. Liking and disliking, not so important anymore. They're there, but they're not so important. And this is directly coming out of our Vipassana practice, that we're not so selective and busy selecting and choosing our experiences. We let things happen as they are. We are with life as it is, moment by moment. And there is the big view. And the big view in the Dharma is always what you might call a relational view. A view that everything is in relationship. You can call it, another expression that I've heard is, participatory universe. That the whole world is participation. We are part of, we are with. The world and us are making each other all the time. That's the, we were just talking at supper about, in the Buddhist world, there's no creator, ein bore, because the world is being made every moment in the interaction of the person and the reality. There's creation happening right now. We're creating this moment together. And this sense of relationship with consciousness, world, arising, things arising, the self arising, me arising, this moment arising, because of conditions, because of causes, because of what was, then there is now. And this sense of dynamic, of karma, if you like, if we can kind of stay with that and know that and be in the dynamic of things arising and being created all the time, fresh and new, that's on the deeper level, that's equanimity, that's our steadiness. A steadiness with a dynamic world that's always being made and remade. The conditions that are rising all the time, creating this moment, creating my life this moment, from based on all the conditions, takes the whole universe to make this moment. And if we can get a taste of that, it's the big view. And the big view encourages us to be, participate. To be part of it, to feel ourselves part of the bigness. And there is a very deep place of equanimity, of being in the middle of things, not knocked over, because we in the world are in the dance all the time. We are dancing together. So when there is no resistance, then our practice takes takes another form. There is no effort. We don't need to struggle. We don't need to push against resistance, which is the habits we have and the sankharas, the patterns and the history and the conditioning. We don't need to push against samsara. And so things become a lot easier. And I'll read to finish. I didn't bring it. I'll read it tomorrow. But there's a sutta where the Buddha said, equanimity is like gold. It's in the end, all our practice goes there. And like gold, in this kind of dynamic being with us and the world, in this awareness of being in the world, being with the world, that's the source of everything that happens. So he used the image of gold, that like a goldsmith that is melting the gold, and then from the gold can make a necklace, can make a ring, can make jewelry, can make anything. The pure gold is the equanimity, and it can be made into anything in our life, and that's a kind of a, on the deeper level, in a way, everything boils down to this equanimity, to this sense of being totally with, no resistance, in the flow, and everything can come from there. Every word we say, every thought that arises, every action that we do in our life. Okay, let's take a few minutes, just quiet.